the nationalist trolling is down and the pro-Putin trolling is up, it's theoretically possible that this is just a shift in the priorities of these Russian troll farms, which are very sophisticated, quite frankly, and they're just kind of shifting their message. That's totally plausible. It also could be that all of us are just paying attention more to Russia and Ukraine. And so if you're watching 10 Russia-Ukraine videos a week instead of none, and then you look at the comments, you're going to notice a lot more pro-Putin propaganda naturally than the hard right American stuff, because that's just the subject matter of the videos you're looking at. So I think what the caller is saying is interesting. We'd have to study it empirically. And that's not something that I've done. But I'm curious to hear whether people in the audience are seeing the same thing. On today's bonus show, calls for the United States to ban Russian oil are gaining momentum, despite concerns about it accelerating inflation even more. We will also talk, as we have spoken before, about the reality that not every military conflict or invasion or war gets the same media coverage. We'll talk about why, and we'll talk about the consequences of that. And lastly, high schools could lose AP classes, advanced placement classes, if they ban so-called required topics from being taught. And we're going to talk about what those topics are and much more. I will reminisce about my AP econ class that I took in high school, which first got me interested in economics and led to me doing economics at the undergraduate and graduate level in college. AP really had a big impact on me. And losing those classes would be a very, very bad thing. You can get access to the bonus show instantly by signing up at joinpacman.com.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT, the inside from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm deeply concerned about civilians trapped in active hostilities in numerous areas, and I urge all parties to take effective action to enable all civilians, including those in situations of vulnerability, to safely leave areas affected by conflict.
As the number of refugees fleeing Ukraine tops 2 million, the United Nations urging Russia and Ukraine to allow all civilians trapped by the fighting safe passage. As we mark International Women's Day, we'll go to Ukraine to speak with an LGBTQ activist who just fled Kyiv to Lviv. Then we go to Moscow to speak with the head of the Memorial Human Rights Center, which has been ordered shut down as part of a widening crackdown on Russian civil society.
We see that all these harsh repressions and growing pressure towards the anti-war protesters and independent media voices was also prepared by the kind of pressure that we experienced before, by the foreign agent law, by the law on undesirable organizations, by the laws that included journalists and all kinds of activists to these categories.
Plus, we speak with Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, the first African refugee to become a member of the U.S. Congress. We'll talk to her about the Russian invasion, the plight of refugees across the globe, and the recent U.S. bombing in her home country of Somalia.
Turning our attention to Somalia, am I correct that all of the airstrikes conducted there under President Biden had been justified under the doctrine of collective self-defense?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine has accused Russian forces of shelling evacuation routes for civilians seeking to flee the Russian invasion. Ukraine's foreign ministry says Russia violated a ceasefire agreement to grant safe passage to civilians in the southern coastal city of Mariupol for a fourth day in a row. Speaking from his office in the capital, Kyiv, on Monday night, President Volodymyr Zelensky slammed Russia for reneging on an agreement, he said, for a humanitarian corridor and for the Kremlin's offer to evacuate civilians only to Russia and Belarus.
They even mined the road that it was agreed would be used to bring in food, medicines for children, for the people of Mariupol. They even destroyed buses that are meant to evacuate people. At the same time, they opened a tiny corridor leading to the occupied territory for a couple dozen of people.
Residents of Mariupol describe a dire humanitarian situation with constant artillery fire, no heat or electricity, despite freezing temperatures. Some residents have reportedly been forced to drink from puddles amid shortages of food and water. Elsewhere in Ukraine, at least 21 people, including 2 children, were killed in an overnight strike in the northeastern city of Sumy. Another Russian attack killed 13 civilians at an industrial bakery in the town of Makariv, west of Kyiv. 4 civilians were killed by Russian mortar fire Sunday as they tried to cross a partially destroyed bridge over the Irpin River. Despite the killings, hundreds of civilians continued to make the journey Monday.
We are from Irpin. There was heavy shelling in Irpin. They fired at houses, people. A woman and a 13-year-old child died. All houses were shelled. A few people left here. It is hard and scary. It is a war. It is fascism. It is genocide against the whole Ukraine. Glory to Ukraine.
The European Union says leaders will meet at a summit this week to discuss ways to phase out the EU's dependency on Russian fossil fuels as it seeks to punish Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. The EU currently imports about half its coal and gas from Russia and about a third of its oil. In Washington, D.C., White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Monday, President Biden has not yet reached a decision on whether to ban U.S. imports of Russian oil.
I would note that what the president is most focused on is ensuring we are continuing to take steps to deliver punishing economic consequences on Putin while taking all action necessary to limit the impact to prices at the gas pump.
Over the weekend, the Biden administration sent a delegation to Venezuela to explore easing oil sanctions as it searches for new sources of energy to replace Russian fossil fuels. The United Nations says more than 2 million people have fled Ukraine since the start of the Russian invasion less than 2 weeks ago. It's the largest and fastest displacement of people in Europe since World War II. More than half the refugees have crossed into neighboring Poland. This comes as hundreds of members of Ukraine's minority Roma population, many of whom are undocumented, report they've been turned around at border crossings and have faced discrimination while trying to flee Ukraine. In Puerto Rico, rights activists are reporting a group of 9 Haitian asylum seekers have been stranded on the island of Desecheo for days without food or water and are in need of urgent medical care. A scuba diving and sailing boat spotted the group over the weekend but was unable to navigate closer to the island located off the west coast of Puerto Rico, so staff contacted the Coast Guard to rescue the group. Democracy Now! Spoke to Catherine Edgerton, an abolition advocate who works with the crew that found the refugee.
We saw some people waving a red cloth from the island, and we got closer to see that there were 9 people on the beach waving for assistance. So we called the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard directed us to not approach, to not offer assistance. When they didn't show up, we packed up some provisions, water, into bags that I could carry, and I swam them in. There were 9 people on the island, one of whom was very ill. All of them were very dehydrated and sunburned and quite desperate for help. They had been there for 3 days. So I swam back to the boat and we called the Coast Guard again. They assured us that they were on the way. And yeah, we were horrified to see 24 hours go by with no Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard has now involved Customs and Border Protection. In a statement, CBP told Democracy Now! Agents were expected to retrieve the Haitian asylum seekers from the island today. Advocates are demanding the asylum seekers be allowed to stay in the United States without the threat of detention or deportation. The United Nations warns conflict in northern Ethiopia has escalated in recent months with widespread reports of civilian deaths, rapes, and other atrocities. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said Monday her staff recorded 304 deaths and 373 injuries attributed to the Ethiopian Air Force since November.
During this period, Ethiopia's human rights and security situation deteriorated significantly, in large part due to the extension of the conflict in Tigray to other parts of northern Ethiopia. Our office continued to receive reports of severe and wide-scale human rights violations in the context of expanding conflict in Afar and Amhara regions, as well as in Tigray.
The UN also warned of a deteriorating human rights situation in Afghanistan, where nearly 400 civilians have been killed in attacks since the Taliban takeover last August. The Biden administration's released a mentally ill torture survivor who was held at the Guantanamo Bay prison for nearly 20 years, most of that time without charge. Mohammed al-Qahtani was diagnosed with schizophrenia long before his capture in Afghanistan in 2001. His condition deteriorated further after he was rendered to Guantanamo in 2002, where he was subjected to 20-hour-per-day interrogations for weeks in which he suffered physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. Al-Qahtani's lawyer, Shaina Kadidal of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said, quote, Mohammed has always belonged in the care of psychiatrists, not in a prison. He survived being tortured and detained at Guantanamo through enormous personal courage, and we're very hopeful that with proper treatment, with his family nearby, he'll learn to manage his symptoms and salvage the remainder of his life. The number of confirmed deaths from coronavirus passed 6 million worldwide 2 years after the start of the pandemic. Researchers believe the true toll is far higher, with disease modelers at University of Washington estimating more than 15 million people have died of COVID-19. Here in the United States, hospitalizations have fallen far below January's record highs, but nearly 1,500 people a day continue to die of COVID-19 in the U.S. on average every day. In Florida, the Surgeon General, Dr. Joseph Ladapo, on Monday shrugged off advice from the Centers for Disease Control that children get vaccinated.
The Florida Department of Health is going to be the first state to officially recommend against the COVID-19 vaccines for healthy children.
The Florida Surgeon General is an anti-mask vaccine skeptic and a proponent of the widely discredited theory of achieving herd immunity through natural infection, which Dr. Anthony Fauci has called nonsense and very dangerous. The Florida Surgeon General was appointed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who last week bullied high school students for wearing masks as they stood behind his lectern at a public event.
You do not have to wear those masks. I mean, please take them. Honestly, it's not doing anything, and we got to stop with this COVID theater. So if you want to wear it, fine, but this is ridiculous.
Governor DeSantis has refused to apologize. His campaign is using the incident to raise funds. Meanwhile, one of the teenagers who he told to take off his mask's mother is immunocompromised and has spoken out. Elsewhere in Florida, protests continue against anti-LGBTQ plus legislation known as the Don't Say Gay Bill that would prohibit discussions about sexual orientation and gender identity at schools. Thousands of students led a massive walkout at Winter Park High School in Orange County, Florida yesterday, chanting, "We say gay." Hundreds more students, teachers, and allies gathered outside and inside the Florida State Capitol in Tallahassee Monday as the bill is now being considered by the Florida State Senate. The U.S. Supreme Court's rejected a bid by North Carolina and Pennsylvania Republicans to restore electoral maps that were struck down by lower courts as illegally gerrymandered. In a 6-3 ruling, justices ruled electoral maps redrawn by courts should be used instead. In Hawaii, the Defense Department is permanently shutting down the Navy's Red Hill fuel storage facility on the island of Oahu. Native water protectors and environmentalists have long fought to close the underground fuel storage. Pressure mounted after a petroleum leak contaminated the water supply that serves over 90,000 families around the naval base of Pearl Harbor. The site also threatened the water safety of other communities as it's located just 100 feet above the primary groundwater aquifer for Honolulu and the rest of Oahu. The Red Hill Bulk Fuel Storage Facility has been used since the 1940s to provide fuel to Pearl Harbor. And thousands of women around the world are taking part in streets to mark International Women's Day today. Actions took place across Turkey, India, Bangladesh, and other regions in recent days. Marches in Pakistan were met with the threat of violence, but women's rights advocates vowed to move forward with rallies in Islamabad and other cities. In Mexico, activists denounced the growing number of femicides in the country. A blimp was seen flying over Mexico City Monday with the words, 10 femicides per day, and no victim is forgotten. Meanwhile, Bolivian feminist groups protested in the capital, La Paz, Monday.
Justice for us all. We have come to demand justice. We have sons and daughters who are crying in our homes, and the judges and prosecutors are not interested in justice. Are you not born of a mother? Do you not have sisters? We only ask for justice.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has entered its 13th day. The United Nations says over 2 million refugees have now fled Ukraine in the largest exodus in Europe since World War II. Ukrainian officials say civilian evacuations have begun after Russia announced a temporary ceasefire in some of the hardest hit areas, including the northeastern city of Sumy, where 21 people, including 2 children, were reported killed in airstrikes just hours before the evacuations began. But Ukraine has accused Russia of shelling civilians fleeing Mariupol, the besieged southern port where many residents have gone days without food or water. Russia is also accused of continuing to attack civilians in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, which has been devastated by days of Russian attacks. One Ukrainian woman named Marina said she was hit by shrapnel from Russia shelling when she went to donate blood. She spoke to Reuters while sitting in a wheelchair at a hospital.
My brother and I came to give blood and we were shelled. The blood transfusion center was shelled. We had just left the center and we were shelled by Russian occupiers. And my brother died on the second day, February 27th. And I remained in hospital with shrapnel wounds in my legs.
Earlier today, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, the former Chilean president, called on all forces to stop targeting civilians.
Since the Council urgent debate, the number of civilian casualties has continued to grow. I'm deeply concerned about civilians trapped in active hostilities in numerous areas, and I urge all parties to take effective action to enable all civilians, including those in situations of vulnerability, to safely leave areas affected by conflict. The office has received reports of arbitrary detention of pro-Ukrainian activists in areas that have recently come under the control of armed groups in the east of the country. We have also received reports of beatings of people considered to be pro-Russian in government-controlled territories. I repeat my urgent call for a peaceful end to hostilities.
As we mark International Women's Day, we're joined by Olena Shevchenko, Ukrainian human rights defender, LGBTI activist, recently fled Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, with her parents and relocated to Lviv in western Ukraine. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Olena. It's great to have you with us. Why don't you just tell us about that journey, what that meant? We'll be showing a map right now of Ukraine going from Kyiv to Lviv. How did your parents handle it? How did you and why did you go?
Hi. Well, honestly, it was a very hard and long way. And it started just day before we left because I was able to transfer my parents from the left bank of the city to the right bank. And it took 4 hours by taxi. And the taxi cost is more than 300 of euros. So you can imagine, for instance, for those people who don't have any money, for instance, in occupied cities, in Kharkiv and Kyiv now, in Mariupol, how they can get out. It's almost not possible. And we had just 2 options to leave the city, is the train and the bus. And the train station, this is obviously not even possible to get on the train because the queues are like for 2 or 3 days. And those of vulnerable communities, I mean, people with disabilities, for instance, women with children, they don't have any chances to get on the trains because this is the huge fight between those who want to leave Ukraine. And it took almost 24 hours to go to the safer place. So, yeah, now I'm in Lviv because it's not possible anymore to stay there. Without electricity, without water, without heat, it's not even possible to do something like to help because we are working now via internet connection. We are trying to help people to escape from those cities. So it's not, no, I don't have any sense to be there without such things. So now I'm in Lviv and we established the shelters here for those who are able to escape at least.
And Elena, you've been, as you said, you've been helping others who are trying to get to safer regions. Could you talk about some of the people that you've been helping and their stories?
You know, I have so many stories now, and I'm not sure if anybody actually want to hear those stories, because mainly stories are about those people who can't even left their houses because they don't have any access to elevators anymore, and they are still at homes. Women who are trying to get out with their parents, people with disabilities, like I said, like elderly people, those who are sick. So I don't know how to help them. And we receive like thousands of messages every day. And you just suffer because you can't help anymore. You can help, I don't know, 10, 20 people a day, but that's thousands of requests. Especially, I'm not talking just about LGBTQI people. We also, the founder of the Women's March, the huge initiative, basically we received through our social networks on from different women, from different cities, the request for help. They don't have medicines, they don't have food, they don't have any chances to survive. Just yesterday, we received a message from two people on the wheelchairs who said they are in Bucha, very near the Kiev, without anything in the basement. And nobody knows who will go there and save them. I'm not sure if they're still alive.
And you mentioned the Women's March. Today is International Women's Day. Could you talk about the impact, especially of this invasion and the fighting now on women and children, and your message to the international community?
My message to international community, you know, that this is not what women invent. I mean, in terms of the war, that's not something we invent. But we are in the center of this war. We are on the center of this humanitarian crisis because women now everywhere. And we heard so many cases now of rapes in these occupied cities. Like I heard like the women screamed, then those Russian troops just sending the videos. And I hear the sound of screaming of women who are in the same time raped by soldiers. I don't think this is like, it's not about heroism. It's not like about heroes. War is a disaster for everybody and it needs to be stopped because that's not about human rights. That's not about geopolitics. That's just a disaster. Why somebody needs to come to other places just, you know, with this aim to put the flag on some buildings and said like, now it's mine. So women are still seen as some things which can be taken. So basically that's still about the power. And that's why we are need to, you know, more solidarity around the world. Not only women, everybody against the war, against the violence. So it was our main message for today's manifestation, which we prepared during the year. But it's not possible now to go to the streets. So that's why we're asking other women in different cities, in different countries, go to the streets and say no to war, say no to violence.
I wanted to ask you about reports of trans Ukrainians unable to leave because their gender identity on their passport did not match their gender identity. That's the case of trans people. And the whole issue of having to show a passport, which so many people do not have. And the discrimination against Roma, black students who are in Ukraine trying to flee, who we interviewed.
Yeah, that's the case. That's almost not possible for those people who have this male documents still, or for other trans people to cross the border. Because during the war, they need to be on the war by law. So basically, they don't have any possibility to leave the country. That's why they are staying in our shelters. And of course, there is an option, like you said, for Roma people as well, just to try to cross the border without documents. But it's also very problematic. Even taking into account that we've been said by different bodies, I don't know, in Ukraine, in different countries, that it will be possible for people without documents to cross the border. But it's not.
I wanted to ask you, Elena, about a group in Ukraine that is trying to reach out to Russian parents or people, relatives of Russians who are looking for their loved ones, Russian soldiers in Ukraine, to see if they're dead. It's an anti-war hotline, and people call in, and the Ukrainians try to get information on those Russian soldiers. These efforts we so rarely hear about, of peace across borders.
I don't know what to say. Yes, we have many small initiatives which are trying to still talk about peace. And of course, it's not like the highly popular team female right now in Ukraine or in other countries, of course. Everybody is more concentrated on the, you know, winning something or who will be the winner of this war. But I don't think that this is a good accent to make. So basically, yes, many people trying to somehow make the connections. And of course, for those who live in Russia, I mean, for mothers, first of all, it's really important to know what happened with their children. I personally don't think they need to be responsible for Putin's actions. I think they need to know the truth.
On that note, Elena Shevchenko, we thank you so much for being with us. Ukrainian human rights defender, LGBTQI activist, recently fled Kyiv with her parents and relocated to Lviv in western Ukraine. Next up, we go to Moscow to speak with the head of the Memorial Human Rights Center, which has been ordered shut down as part of a widening crackdown on Russian civil society, as we continue to honor International Women's Day. Stay with us. Meredith Monk's Ellis Island. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue our coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we go to Moscow, where the Russian government's intensifying its crackdown on civil society, the independent press, and anti-war protesters. Over the past 2 weeks alone, more than 13,000 Russian protesters have been arrested after taking to the streets in scores of cities denouncing the invasion. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a law that imposes jail terms of up to 15 years for the spreading of so-called false information about the military or its activity in Ukraine. Media organizations are now barred from describing Russia's actions in Ukraine as an invasion or a war. Earlier today, the former Chilean president, Michelle Bachelet, now the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, criticized the Russian crackdown.
In the Russian Federation, the space for discussion or criticism of public policies, including its military action against Ukraine, is increasingly and profoundly restricted. Some 12,700 people have been arbitrarily arrested for holding peaceful anti-war protests, and media are being required to use only official information and terms. I remain concerned about the use of repressive legislation that impedes the exercise of civil and political rights and criminalizing nonviolent behavior. Fundamental freedoms and the work of human rights defenders continue to be undermined by widespread use of the 2012 so-called foreign agent law, as evidenced by the judicial closure of two organizations set up by the widely respected civil society group Memorial.
That was Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking earlier today. We're joined now by the head of the Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow, which Bachelet referenced in her remarks. In December, the Memorial Human Rights Center was ordered shut down, along with its sister organization, Memorial International. Both groups were accused of violating Russia's foreign agent law. Anna Dobrovolskaya, the executive director of the Memorial Human Rights Center, is joining us now from Moscow. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the situation right now in Moscow, in Russia overall, when it comes to dissent, and what's happening to the Memorial Human Rights Center?
Yes. Hello, everyone. Hello, Amy and Juan, and thank you for having me here. The situation in Moscow is quite complicated. A lot of human rights activists, independent journalists, even musicians, theater people, poets, and activists of all kind are fleeing the country. They are going somewhere to the safe places from where they can continue talking openly without being sanctioned by the law you have just mentioned. There are also organizations who are staying within the country and trying to help during the peaceful protests, trying to help the refugees which will be coming also to Russia from Ukraine, and who are basically trying to keep their regular work because, as usually, the level of human rights violations, of torture, of police abuse, and the level of general brutality of the state is quite high. And unfortunately, without these organizations, we don't know how longer the Russian society can be able to function.
And Anna, back last year in August, your center published an updated version of the list of political prisoners in Russia. At the time, you said there were 410 people, a sharp increase from about 46 in 2015. Can you talk about who some of these people are and why there's been such a huge increase in recent years in political prisoners?
Yeah, because after 2014 and after the annexation of Crimea, the situation in Russia tightened up for civil society and for independent groups and activists. We had to split our list of political prisoners into two parts, and one part particularly includes only those people who are included to the list because they are persecuted for being a part of a religious minority or of a certain group. And majority of those groups are different Muslim groups, including the Crimean Tatars. Not all the Crimean Tatars ethnically, but those who are members of particular religious communities. It also recently included Jehovah Witnesses and other religious minorities. So it's about more than 100 people are from those groups. And the rest are just people who are being accused of either violating the freedom of assembly and organization laws, or are being accused of saying something extremist in social media, or they are supporters of Alexei Navalny, and the list goes on. So basically, it's the approach of the Russian government to widely and disseminately put some limitations on the people who are just willing to speak openly and are willing to express their opinion. And a lot of that started happening also after the Crimea events. But basically, the first limitation of freedom of speech and the first limitation for NGO laws were imposed in Russia since 2006. So it's a very long story.
And in terms of this foreign agents law and the label, your organization was accused of justifying terrorism and failing to use on its publication the foreign agent label. What is this law and how do they interpret it in Russia?
Finally, in the final court decision, the extremism and terrorism allegations were dropped, and we are just the violent offenders of the foreign agent law. The law itself says that if some organization or a media institution or a person receives foreign donations and is performing political activity, this organization or this person can be included to the foreign agent list. Official people from Russia keep saying that this is a copy of the Foreign Agent Registration Act from the United States. We made lots of analysis proving that this has nothing to do with FARA. But political activity is in this law is understood as saying anything publicly which does not always fall in line with the official with the official ideas of the government or governmental institutions. And foreign donations or foreign funding can also be very differently defined. It can be from $1 received from Armenia, or it can be for organizations like ours. Our budget is quite huge because we operate in different regions, and of course we mostly operate thanks to the foreign donations. If you are a foreign agent, you have to put a huge label on all your publications and social media, on all your printed like leaflets and reports and stuff like that. And at the moment we were included to the foreign agent list, there was still no clear regulations in the law, like where you should put this label, how this should look like. And still there is no clear regulations for NGOs, but this doesn't stop the courts from closing us down for violating the law.
Can you describe on police raids in your offices and of Memorial International what that looks like?
Yeah, we just had a police raid on our office this Friday. As far as we know, unfortunately, all the people who were present there signed the NDA, the official NDA, and they cannot talk much about it. But as far as we got from the news and from the police officers, the search is related to, again, anti-terrorism case against our former colleague, who is not even a colleague or a staff member anymore. He is working with the Uzbek migrant communities, and he's also working with some of the religious Muslim minorities in Russia, and some of those minority groups, such as Hizbut Tahrir, are banned altogether, though they're being quite peaceful. They're banned and are called extremists. And though he was no longer a colleague of ours, I think we all consider this as police just used this as an excuse to enter the premises and take the financial documentations, take the computers, take lots of stuff. And it's actually the second attempt of the police raid. The first one happened earlier last autumn when we were showing the movie about the hunger in Ukraine, about the Holodomor. It was a Polish movie. We again had police raiding through our office, but that time, thanks to the brilliant legal work, we were able to stop them. Unfortunately, this time they just entered and they were quite brutal. Well, no one was beaten up or anything, but no one was allowed, no lawyers were allowed, and of course we consider all of this again as a violation of the law. Clearly we will be opposing it, of course, but it looks like, yeah, the government is just trying to close everything down.
Yeah, and talking of closing everything down, the crackdown has come not just on NGOs, but also on independent journalism. Could you talk about that as well?
Yes, the first, I think the first list of individuals, foreign agents, it was emerged in 2020 or 2019. And at the moment, there were like people, individuals included to the list. And then the government started including to this list a lot of independent media, a lot of those who were working with investigations, such as Panama Papers and very similar stories. So majority of those media institutions had to close down. I think there are at least of 20 media foreign agents, at least 20, but I'm afraid there are more. And very often, not just the media institution is being included to the list of foreign agents, but also the major journalists themselves or the major editors. And if you are the individual who is included to the foreign agent list, sorry for this. So if you are an individual included to the foreign agent list, you have to, again, put this label on all your personal social media, and you have to be very precise with all your accounting and stuff like that.
I wanted to ask you, Anna, about the comparisons of what's happening in Ukraine, Russia's invasion, to what Russia did to Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, the leveling of a city, one of the most destroyed cities in the world. At the time, because Russia said it was going after Islamic extremists, much of the world did not rise up. But now they're using the example without talking about what the context was to say, is this what they're doing to Ukraine? Can you talk about that comparison? We're talking
yes,
to...
sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you yourself, Amy, you mentioned the law which kind of prohibits Russian citizens of talking very openly about what is happening in Ukraine. We're supposed to call it special military operations, and that's a lot of actually media outlets had to close down because of that. From what we can see in international media or in Ukrainian sources, yes, it is. It looks like a lot of tactics that were used in Chechnya are being used again in civilian objects or in cities in Ukraine. And it's very, very unfortunate what is happening there. And we can only hope that some negotiations or some, I don't know, some peaceful minds can be able to stop it as soon as possible. Because
finally,
it's a huge tragedy. Yeah.
How much are you risking by speaking out right now from Moscow?
If we stick to the words I just said, it's I think it's okay. I think that people who go there to the streets holding the anti-war posters, they're risking way more because it's not just being held up in a cold police car. You can be beaten very brutally. You can be investigated very harshly. There is now a lot of people who are being also taken to the hospital after those raids by the police. And if you are detained for the second and third time, you are facing up to 15 years in prison. So I really admire those people who go in the streets. And unfortunately, not every one of us is able to take such risks, especially those people who are from the civil society, because we have to take care of a lot of things on the ground besides the peaceful protests. But we can only hope that, yes, it will be over soon.
Anna Dubrovolskaya, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of Memorial Human Rights Center, speaking to us from Moscow, Russia. Next up, we turn to Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, the first African refugee to become a member of Congress. We'll talk about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the plight of the more than 2 million refugees that have just fled Ukraine, and also refugees across the globe, as well as the recent U.S. bombing in her home country of Somalia. Stay with us. The Somali group 4MARS singing Guide Us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine on this International Women's Day, earlier today, the United Nations said more than 2 million refugees had fled Ukraine in the largest exodus in Europe since World War II. We're joined now by Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who knows something about being a refugee. Her family came to the U.S. as Somali refugees. She's the first African refugee to become a U.S. congressmember. Earlier this week, she criticized reports that senior advisors to President Biden may be planning a visit to Saudi Arabia to discuss global oil supplies as the U.S. considers a ban on importing Russian oil. Congressmember Omar tweeted, quote, "Our response to Putin's immoral war shouldn't be to strengthen our relationship with the Saudis, who are currently causing the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen. Yemenis might not matter to some geopolitically, but their humanity should. This is a wildly immoral act," Congressmember Ilhan Omar tweeted. Well, she's joining us now back on Democracy Now! Congressmember Omar, welcome to Democracy Now! On this International Women's Day.
Good to be with you, Amy.
Why don't you start off with that tweet, with that comment that you made about now the U.S.'s search for more oil as it cuts off taking oil from Russia. Can you talk about that first, the plan to go to Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's good to be with you, Amy, and good morning to everyone. It's hard to see a principle at play here. If our issue is that we don't want to buy oil from a powerful country that is conducting a devastating war on its weaker neighbor, I just don't see Saudi Arabia hardly being a principled solution. We know that MPS is obviously going to try to take advantage of this opportunity to once again whitewash his reputation and present himself as a reformer, and we shouldn't fall for that. The truth is our dependency on oil means that we depend on tyrants, and that has always been true. So if we are obviously serious about what we need to do in regards to the Ukraine context, we should be supporting and defending democracy and human rights, and we should certainly move away. Then we should certainly move away from our dependency on fossil fuels and not be cozying up once again to another tyrant.
Congresswoman, I wanted to ask you, the U.S. has provided enormous military support to Ukraine, sending 17,000 anti-tank weapons just in the last 6 days, and billions more of President Biden is requesting in military aid. And interestingly, while the rest of the stock market has been plummeting in the United States, the stocks of defense contractors have soared. General Dynamics, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin all have the highest stock prices they have had in 30 years because they're obviously building these javelins and these other missiles that are being the United States is buying. What's the debate like in Congress right now about the degree of aid that the United States should be supplying?
Well, it's interesting you bring up the soaring stock market for those that profit from war and the conflict of interest that we are obviously experiencing here in Congress, because we have colleagues that are actually currently buying those specific stocks because they understand that war can be profitable for them and for everyone, which is unfortunate. It's heartbreaking to see what's happening in Ukraine. We obviously want to help the Ukrainians defend themselves. But I've cautioned my colleagues on what, could be the catastrophe that awaits us if we continue to send billions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine instead of really thinking about what kind of weapons we're sending. You know, if we're continue to give small arms and ammunition, those can ultimately get in the hands of the wrong people and can have a lasting effect. We have to be able to learn something from history. We did this in Afghanistan when Afghanistan was fighting against the Soviet. We ultimately saw what happened with the resources that we gave, the support that we gave in that country, and who we ultimately ended up propping up. And so I do hope that my colleagues obviously learn from history and that we respond in a measured way.
Just days before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene bought up to $15,000 in stock in the military contractor Lockheed Martin. Congressmember Omar, you tweeted in response, add this to the list of why members of Congress should never be allowed to trade stocks. Can you comment further?
Of course. I mean, we've seen the kind of conflict of interest this presents. Members of Congress have information that could attribute to inside trading, and ultimately, if they are not breaking the law, they are still having a conflict of interest, and we should be in the business of having a clear conscience when we are making these decisions as policymakers on behalf of our country. Congressional members should never be allowed to trade stock. Their family members and their dependents shouldn't as well. I think it is time for us to ban stock trading for members of Congress, because, you know, the evidence is there. Not only did we see people profiting from the pandemic, we are now seeing them profit from war.
And Congresswoman, I'd like to ask you, Ukraine has been urging the United States and NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine. President Biden and the Europeans have said that they do not want to do that because they don't want to expand the conflict further. But the media also have been, a lot of the corporate media have been almost pressuring the administration to do so. What's your sense of the of this issue of the no-fly zone and where members of Congress stand on it?
So when the Ukrainians ask us to implement a no-fly zone, that's an invitation for us to get involved in the war. A no-fly zone is not something that, you know, is just implemented. It's something that has to be militarily defended. And that ultimately means the United States and our NATO allies will be a part and parcel to this war. And when we get involved in this war, it's not that less Ukrainians are going to die. More Ukrainians are going to die. And we have to be able to have an honest conversation about what an escalation in this war could ultimately mean, not just for Ukrainians, but for the rest of the world.
And in terms of the sanctions that have already been imposed, you've expressed some concerns about some of the sanctions. Could you talk about that as well?
Yeah, I mean, we are sanction happy as a nation. And, you know, ultimately, it is important for us to support some sanctions on Putin and his allies to make sure that they feel the pain and the consequences of their actions. But what I do want the American people and everyone around the world to understand is that as we urge, you know, Russians who are anti-war, that these sanctions that we are cheering for and implementing will ultimately have an impact on the very people that we want to rise up and make sure that they are speaking against this illegal, immoral, and unjust war on a sovereign country.
I wanted to ask you about another tweet. Just 1 week ago, President Biden gave his State of the Union address. You recently tweeted, "Thank you, POTUS. I was proud to sign a letter in support of TPS for Ukrainians. I have also signed letters asking for TPS for Cameroonians and Ethiopians. Those deserve the same urgency." Can you talk about the way the media covers Ukraine versus other absolute crises in the world? Some have noted that when you're talking about white Christians who are victims, and not only Christians, but others in Ukraine, you have a much more sense of urgency than, for example, what's happening in the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in the world, which is in Yemen, not to mention what's happening with refugees from other countries, if you could comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's heartwarming to see the incredible support from European countries, the United States, and everyone around the world that the Ukrainians are experiencing, right, as they flee war. Everyone fleeing war deserves this level of compassion and hospitality. Some of the countries that are welcoming Ukraine now are the same countries that have been stroking fear against refugees who were fleeing the Syrian war, the war in Libya, and many other wars around the world. And it is a fact that, you know, many of the Syrian refugees were also fleeing Putin's brutality as he's helped Assad's regime waged devastation on his people. We also know that there are more than 2 million people that are being displaced in Ethiopia as we speak right now. There are people from Haiti, Central America, to Bangladesh, to Afghanistan, and so many other places that are being displaced. And there are more people that are considered refugees and immigrants in the world right now than at any point in our, you know, in world history. And so, you know, we know that it's going to get worse as climate change gets worse. And I hope that we seize this moment to really start enacting policies that treat all people who are fleeing war and devastation the same way that we are treating Ukrainians at this moment.
I also want to ask you about your home country, about Somalia. In February, U.S. Africa Command in Somalia conducted an airstrike that was reportedly in response to an al-Shabaab attack on partner forces. Last week, the House Foreign Affairs Committee held a hearing on the 2001 AUMF and war powers, and you asked the General Counsel of the Pentagon, Caroline Crass, about Somalia. This is a clip.
Our attention to Somalia, am I correct that all of the airstrikes conducted there under President Biden had been justified under the doctrine of collective self-defense?
Congresswoman, the strikes in Somalia have been conducted under the authority of the 2001 AUMF. And I know that at least some have been in defense of partner forces.
Mm-hmm. Including the February 22nd strike?
Yes.
So that strike got very little attention in the U.S. media. It was the first U.S. bombing of Somalia since August. Can you talk about its significance and what you're most concerned about, Congressmember Omar? This is your home country, where you fled from.
Yeah, I mean, my concerns are deeply rooted in these military activities that we continue to engage in that, you know, really are flying under the radar. Most Americans aren't aware of our military activities around the world, let alone countries like Somalia. And it's really important that, you know, we shed light on how the AUMF, the 2001 AUMF, has been utilized, and it's currently in effect in more than 20 countries. Many of the members of Congress then who voted to authorize that, authorized it for our work in Afghanistan. And it is time for us to examine it and repeal it. I think, you know, if we are going to continue to engage in war in countries like Somalia, we need new authorization and reasoning for the activities that are taking place and, you know, military actions that are being committed with U.S. tax dollars and in our name.
And speaking of those military actions, the Trump administration removed several hundred U.S. Soldiers that were functioning supposedly as advisors in Somalia. But there's talk about bringing them back, under the, or at least some of them, under the Biden administration. What's your feeling about this issue of so many American soldiers being stationed in these several of these countries under the war on terrorism?
Yeah, again, you know, we definitely need to reexamine and have a deeper conversation. I think members of Congress in previous years have not done their oversight duties in trying to go after and investigate some of these actions that have been taken. It's important for us to also realize that we don't just have the known, you know, military posts that people often talk about. But there are military actions that are taking place in countries like Somalia, where we talk about being an advisory, but we are literally engaged in activities of war. Somalia is obviously challenged by terrorism. Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization. They are causing havoc to lives of citizens in Somalia. Many of the people that are being displaced in Somalia right now are not being displaced because of the civil war that displaced my family when I was a child. They're being displaced because of terrorism and because of climate change.
We're going to have to leave it there. Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, streaming online at wrct.org.
People.
get enough.